This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Green from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
We are off and rolling on a Tuesday, April 8, 2025 is the date. Welcome into the Gabe Kuhn Show. I am your host, former Memphis Tiger Gabe Kuhn on X at _Kuhn71. I'm alongside the executive producer of the show, Connor Dunning on X at C99. Connor, how's it going, brother?
What's up, man?
Man, good to hear from you. Good to see your face. We have a lot to get into today in very little time. Hate to put it that way, but that's the truth of it. We have an hour and a half of talk on the way, courtesy of 92.9 FM, ESPN, and yours truly. We have to pass you off to Grizzlies at Hornets. Only four games left. They started 2-0 in this last six. We know that there's that unbelievable sort of logjam from about 3-8 in the Western Conference. Everybody is tied with the same amount of losses. We need to get to that at 5:30, and then tip will be at 6 o'clock with Eric Hasenstein. But we are going to be loaded. Christian Fowler at 4:30 instead of 6 because we don't have a third hour. And then at 5 o'clock, we'll bring on Jeff Calkins to talk about it. We have a new national champion, by the way. So there is that. Shout out to the Florida Gators. They win 65-63 last night and capture their first national championship since they went back-to-back in 2006 and 2007 with that team. Joakim Noah, Corey Brewer. You had Al Horford. Really good teams back then. But Todd Golden at age 39 gets to the top of the mountaintop, and I thought it was phenomenal. I'm going to ask this question off the top to you, Connor. Was it more last night about Houston floundering in the moment for the first time just about all year, or was it more about Florida being able to take advantage of those moments? Because that's the debate I am having in my head right now. Which one really led to this outcome?
I think Houston blew it.
Yeah.
Houston blew it. They could not score the basketball. They had nobody that could play offense outside of Cryer, and Florida stepped up, and their defense was really good. But at the same time, I also thought that the coaching mattered.
Yep.
I thought that Samson got outcoached in the final 10 minutes of that game, and not having your best offensive player get a shot off on your final two possessions is rough.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I think that Houston blowing it was very much illustrated by the final play of the game. And this right here is how it sounded.
Dan, give it up. Cryer, 6 seconds, 5 seconds, Sharp.
He walked. He can't touch it.
He can't. 1 second. And it's over. Florida is back on top of the college basketball world championship madness. It's a great day to be a Gator. They win the national title.
That was Ian Eagle on the call for CBS Sports. But that final play, I think, is an illustration of what you're talking about. Houston blowing it. They were not able to get up a field goal attempt on their last four possessions. Emmanuel Sharp had two turnovers. I'll get to more on him in a second. But that final play, you have a quick closeout from Walter Clayton Jr. Emmanuel Sharp took an hour and a half to try to get up a three. He realizes it's going to get blocked late. He's too much in the air to give a pump fake, so he just drops the ball on the floor. He cannot pick it up. I know there's been some debate about that because he had not started dribbling, but he cannot pick it up or it was going to be a walk. It was going to be a travel, and the violation sends it directly Florida's way, and they win the game anyway. I do think I agree with Kelvin Sampson. A pump fake would have been nice in that situation for Emmanuel Sharpe.
Yeah, definitely.
Walter Clayton Jr. is closing out for the national championship. He is coming like a bat out of hell. Make sure that you have a shot if he's closing out that hard. If he doesn't, pump fake, and then you'll get an open shot. You can get downhill. You can do what you need to do. But Emmanuel Sharpe, my heart goes out to the guy. It is as bad as he blew it last night. It's hard not to feel some really tough feelings, some hard feelings for the guy. Like, forgettable final minute and a half. He committed the turnover to allow Florida to take the lead with about a minute left. Then that final play, he jumps, puts the ball on the ground, and it ends the game. Houston's last 2 minutes, 0 points, zero field goal attempts, four turnovers. And to break it down further, Houston had four turnovers in the first 36-35 of the 40 minutes. And Houston turned it over five times in the final 3:24. And, you know, Emmanuel Sharpe had his problems down the stretch. I thought coaching-wise, Kelvin Sampson didn't get the ball into L.J. Cryer's hands enough, his best offensive player. Jaywan Roberts wasn't finishing around the rim. I certainly just put it this way. I think that the moment got too big for Houston down the stretch. And I think another example of that, and I don't think it's being talked about enough, Milos Juzan, their point guard. Where was he? Where were you, Milos? I'm confused. You're an all-conference point guard. In the Big 12, your team went 19-1, in part because of the play you gave them throughout the year setting things up. And I hate to put it this way, it genuinely felt like he was hiding for most of the second half, trying not to make a mistake. It felt like that team tightened up and played not to lose and didn't play to win, where Florida on the other side, to their credit, was ready to go win that game.
Right.
Houston only had 5 assists in the game. That is the fewest they've had in a single game since 2020. I just think they found adversity, whether it was foul trouble, guys getting tired. Florida figured out what Houston was offensively. They're not very good on that end of the floor. All of these things came together, and it finally overwhelmed Houston. It took 39 games and 36 minutes into the 40th game for the wheels to fall off, but they fell off. And I also want to get to this. Jaywan Roberts, he's been there for 6 years, and hard not to feel bad for him as well. This was his last opportunity. He's been there with Kelvin Sampson that entire time. He spoke to the pain he and his team felt after the game and also to his 6 years under Kelvin Sampson. Go ahead and give this a listen.
Coach Sampson's been everything to me. From Coach Sampson down to grandkids, everybody played a part in me being here for 6 years. And I wanted it so bad for him. So bad. And it hurts because I can't do it next year. I can't put myself in position to do it next year. This will be my last time wearing my jersey, and I feel terrible. But I told a younger guy, to the returners, to remember this feeling. So when you in this moment again, or you're in this situation again, you'll be on top. And I feel like everything you go through in life is a lesson. And, you know, I'm glad I could play with LJ. You know, glad I played with all those guys. But Coach Sampson, the role that he played in my life, you know, it's, I can't even put into words.
It means something to all of those guys on that Houston roster that they lost that game in that opportunity, and they wanted it for Kelvin Sampson. Sometimes you'll see coaches get rallied around for in a negative light, you know, a common enemy. Bobby Knight was that way. I think Chris Beard, to a certain extent, is like that for Ole Miss because of how much he emulates Bobby Knight and loves Bobby Knight. You look at Kelvin Sampson, though, he does it the opposite way. I feel like people rally around him in a very positive way, and to see Jaywan Roberts show that type of emotion in that moment, really tough to watch, man. Guy that gave his all to that program, Kelvin Sampson took an opportunity on him, when no one else would. And here's the truth of a guy like Juwan Robertson, most of that team, like a lot of those guys would just be role players elsewhere, but because they are attached to Kelvin Sampson and have done what he has said for all of these years, year over year, the continuity they've had, they had this opportunity they just weren't able to get through. So with all that, Florida completed a 12-point second half comeback. And the reason I asked that question off the top of the show, Connor, was it more about Houston flailing around in the final minutes and you know, failing? Or was it more about Florida coming back? Is because, you know, Florida has done this multiple times in this tournament. They led for a total of 104 last night, which to me, you know, on the surface for one game, a one-off would be surprising. But it's not surprising when you bring up what they have done through the final three rounds of this tournament. Florida's the only national champion over the last 20 years to overcome a deficit of 9-plus points in the Elite Eight national semifinal, the Final Four, and then the national championship. They were down by 10 against Texas Tech, down by 9 against Auburn, down by 12 against Houston. So this team was unbelievably resilient, and I thought the guy who won Most Outstanding Player, which no surprise there, did not have a good first half, didn't make a single field goal, but Walter Clayton Jr., I thought, embodied that last night. He stayed within himself, handled business in the second half, still was dishing out assists when he wasn't knocking down any shots and Houston was playing that smothering defense. And ultimately, I thought he was one of the bigger heroes last night. Now, Will Richard had a really good game. I think he had 19 points. Elijah Martin didn't quite show up, but at the same time, Walter Clayton Jr. was able to get over how the first half went and lead his team to victory down the stretch. I thought that was very impressive by him. Considering the way he had been playing versus how he was playing last night, a lot of guys can go into a shell and get nervous and try to hide. Walter Clayton Jr. didn't do that, and Florida was better because of it.
Absolutely. They deserve a ton of credit because they hung in there. They never let Houston run away with it. And that's why when Houston was up by 12, it really felt like at that moment that they could have blown it open, but they just didn't have any offense, and Florida really locked down defensively. They forced turnovers, and like you said, in that first half, they could not turn Houston over at all, but in the second half, especially in the final 10 minutes of the game, their defense was unbelievable. They deserve all the credit in the world, and at the end of the day, they had shot makers, and Houston
sure.
did not. Just came out of that. Florida made their shots when they needed to.
Sure, but let's talk about the real story there. Houston didn't get up a shot.
No, well,
as much as
they were taking shots. I'm saying at the end of the day,
the final four
Florida
possessions, they didn't get up a shot.
Florida could hit a three, and Houston couldn't.
Yes, Florida had more offensively than Houston did at that moment, and it's because Florida really locked in on the defensive side, made sure that they won the half court battle, which I've seen people talk about, like the differences between NBA basketball and college basketball, because you can pack the paint, you can play harder defense, those types of things. Like just to see. Down the stretch, the team in a close game in the NCAA tournament who is able to win the half-court battle is going to win the game. And I thought that Florida did that probably slightly better than Houston. It wasn't hard to do it slightly better than Houston because, again, they didn't get up a shot in their last four possessions. But the differences between the NBA and college basketball I thought were highlighted last night, not just by the final score, 65-63, but the fact that in the NBA – there's sometimes, like, you don't have stoppers. You cannot just stop Luka Doncic. You can't just stop Nikola Jokic. You can't just do those things. Walter Clayton Jr. got stopped last night, but the rest of his team was able to lift up and figure it out on the offensive end, figure it out on the defensive end, win the half-court battle on both ends of the floor against that Houston team who was so damn good at it, quite frankly.
Yeah, it was interesting to watch in the second half because the entire time, you just kind of always felt like, or at least I did, that Florida was going to eventually take the lead. And it just felt like a matter of time because Houston had all of these opportunities. And you brought it up. Roberts missed so many buckets around the rim that you just knew it was going to catch up to them. And I don't think it would be fair for us to talk about this game without talking about some of the calls that happened too.
Sure.
The referees flipped the momentum in this game a few different times. One time they flipped it for Houston, no doubt about it. It was one of the reasons they were able to get that 12-point lead. But then they flipped it back to the Gators with those three straight calls against Houston. And at the end of the day, the free throw difference ended up mattering kind of big. You know, the Gators got to the free throw line 21 times. Houston only got to the free throw line 14 times. One team was able to be a little bit more physical in the second half than the other was. I do wish we got to see a game that had consistent calls throughout the entire time. If you're going to allow them to play physical in the first half, you should also be allowing them to play physical in the second half.
All right. Now, I this is this thought that I couldn't shake, especially down the stretch for Houston. And I understand that, like, Florida, they didn't have – like, Walter Clayton was a zero-star recruit. Like, he was a football recruit. He was a four-star football recruit and was a zero-star basketball recruit. And it's absolutely insane to think about. It's not like Florida has, like, these – a bunch of five-stars littered throughout their roster. But I thought they had more talent, you know, pound for pound, more size, more athleticism than Houston had. I hate to say this way, but this is how I felt down the stretch. Houston, as much as I love Kelvin Sampson and I appreciate the way he gets his players to rally – in the end of the day, you just look at that team and you're like, who are these guys? Like, truthfully, who the hell are these guys? Emmanuel Sharp, Jawan Roberts. I know who L.J. Cryer is. That's about the only guy that you look at. He was at Baylor. He was really good previous to coming to Houston. But you look at some of these guys and you're just like, from a talent perspective, you always get the sense that it may catch up to them. It just caught up to them in the final minute and 4 seconds as opposed to earlier in the tournament.
They needed one more guy. They were one guy away. They needed one more guy.
One more shot maker, man.
Well, because what Houston was doing to Florida is they were basically doubling Clayton the entire game, and they were forcing the rest of the team to beat them. And that is why Will Richard deserves all the credit in the world. Because I know they only hit 6 threes as a team, Florida did, but him hitting four of them and when he made them were massive every single time.
One of the biggest adjustments I have to give Todd Golden credit for, especially last, I don't know, 6 to 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The whole first half, he was making it easy on Houston to throw doubles and switch on the Walter Clayton Jr., and that's why he couldn't make a shot. Because he kept running pick and rolls up there, adding a body to the situation. In the last 10 minutes, you know what he did?
Double screen.
In the last 10 minutes, you know what he did for Walter Clayton Jr.? He said, okay, we're not going to bring a pick and roll. You go cook. We're going to give you an ISO situation against whoever is guarding you. You go get to the rim. You go find a shot. Go figure it out. And you saw a couple of and ones down the stretch of the game. I didn't understand the whole first half. He kept trying to bring these high pick and rolls for Walter Clayton Jr. And in some situations, you would see Thomas Hall open at the rim, Alex Condon open at the rim. And I sort of saw.
Can we talk about Condon real quick?
I saw why he was going with that early, but eventually you needed to switch that up. Stop bringing that high pick and roll all that much. And he did in that last 10 minutes. I thought it was the biggest difference for Florida offensively.
He also started running a double pick for him. Like, because the defenders were just chasing him, and they were just having Condon set picks, Chinyalu set picks for him. It was weird because it was like the teams flipped in the second half, especially in the final 10 minutes, because all of a sudden Houston just tried to, you know, run pick and roll, high pick and roll. They couldn't do anything. They would double L.J. Cryer. He'd throw the ball to Roberts. He'd brick a layup, and that's kind of what their offense looked like for the final 10 minutes. One of the funniest trends, though, of the entire game, Condon. Listen, when you look at his stat line, it looks great. Like, he had 12 points, 7 rebounds, 4 steals. If you were watching the game, that man wanted nothing to do with the basketball. Every time he would catch it in the paint, he was, Gabe, wide ass open.
Yeah.
Wide open. Yeah. And he would be like, it was like hot potato. He was like, somebody take it from me, somebody take it from me. Blow the whistle, blow the whistle.
He
didn't want the basketball at all.
I don't think really any of the bigs, and Thomas Hall, I think, is the exception here. I thought he played really well last night. I don't think any of the bigs for Florida were ready for the level of physicality that was coming to them.
Not at all.
Especially, they figured
so
it out eventually and ultimately won the game, but I don't think they were ready for the physicality they were going to get from JoJo Tugler and Jawan Roberts at 6'8" or 6'7", whatever those guys are.
Tugler's foul trouble mattered, too.
Yeah, it did.
That was big time.
It did. It was big adversity that hit, and they just weren't quite able to get over top. And I saw Evan Mia give out his postseason awards. Evan Miyakawa does a really good job, really good analytics site for college basketball if you want to go check it out. But he gave JoJo Tugler the Defensive Player of the Year, according to his metrics. So that did matter. It absolutely mattered that he wasn't able to stay on the floor but for 16 minutes. As a guy who needs to play in a game like that down the stretch, probably get to the 25-30 minute mark.
It was just an absolutely brutal loss for Houston, though, because they had it. And you know, another thing that I think is going a little bit under-discussed today is that goaltending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's tough.
I hear you. But Florida gets over top. Good for Todd Golden. At 39 years old, he's already stamped himself as one of the best in college basketball. Really good. I didn't think he coached a perfect game last night, but it was good enough in the end for them to get over top 65-63. Now, as far as a review is concerned for the Final Four, I think that's due because of all the conversations that were had about this tournament being chalky and 4-1 seeds and the separation between the haves and have-nots. I'll say this right now. I give this an absolute positive A.
It was incredible.
It's an A. You went 3-for-3 from the Final Four into the national championship game. Every single game came down to the final few possessions, and the matchups were as promised, to be honest with you. Very good. And you had contrasting styles, too, which I think matters in these situations. Auburn, really good offensive team, can play with physicality with their front court. You have Houston, who really not a very good offensive team, but defensively they are absolutely ridiculous. Florida, a top five offensive team in the entire country. And Duke was that freshman-laden team who just could do it all for the most part. I know they bowed out in the Final Four to that Houston team, but I thought you had a good contrasting of styles and just straight up good personalities, good coaching. Everything about that Final Four into the national championship game leads me to believe that that was an A, potentially an A+.
Without a doubt. The championship game came down to literally the final possession, and it was intense the entire time. I have no allegiances to either of these teams. I was rooting for Houston because I picked them to win the bracket, and I wanted Samson to get a championship. And, you know, I got Tennessee thing, so I don't necessarily like Florida. But at the same time, it was an enthralling basketball game. I texted you like 5 times, like, this is so intense.
This is great.
It was great. And it came down to the final buzzer. I loved it. The Final Four was electric. Both games were great. And then you had just a 10 out of 10 championship game that came down to quite literally the final possession. You can't ask for anything else.
Yeah, and the SEC, by the way,
captures
their national championship. So that conversation about SEC or the field that we had 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, you know who you should have picked. Should have been the SEC the entire time. Now let's go ahead and move on because the story of the day, outside of the national championship and Florida being able to win for the first time since 06-07, Michael Malone has been fired. Fired by the Denver Nuggets amid a 4-game losing streak. It's tied for the latest coaching change in NBA history. We're 4 games to the end. Hubie Brown is the only one that has been fired at this time of the season in the NBA's history, and that was in 1980 and 1981 when he was coaching for the Atlanta Hawks. But that was a 31-51 basketball team. A little more understood why he was getting gone. Now, I think there's a misnomer about where the Nuggets are at, so I'm going to go ahead and get ahead of that. Some people will look at the standings and say, well, the Nuggets are in fourth. How could you even think about making this decision? They're fourth in the West. Well, their real seed is more likely seventh because of the tie-breaking scenarios and the 5-way tie we have between, what, the 3-8 or 4-8, whatever the hell it is. So their real seed is more seventh. They just have one more win than the rest of the field, one more win than the teams that they're tied in the loss column with. But they're 3-7 in their last 10, 11-13 since the All-Star break. David Adelman, who is the lead assistant, was the lead assistant for Michael Malone, is going to take over as the interim. He's the son of former NBA coach Rick Adelman. He was a Timberwolves assistant from 2011 to 2016, Magic assistant in the 2016-17 season. He's been the Nuggets assistant with Michael Malone starting in 2017 to 2025. The thought here, per Shams, was that Nuggets brass felt like the signs were there that the season was not going to end well. That sounds very familiar. That sounds like what happened last week with Taylor Jenkins. But with this, Michael Malone being fired from the Nuggets, 4 of the last 6 NBA coaches to win the finals are no longer with the team that they won with. He joins Nick Nurse with the Raptors in 2019, Frank Vogel with the Lakers in 2020, Mike Budenholzer with the Bucks in 2021, and of course him, he won it in 2023, and now he is out of a job. This is insane. There's no other way to put it. Absolutely insane. Michael Malone is the regular season win record holder as a head coach for the Nuggets franchise with 471. He has the most playoff wins in Nuggets franchise history with 44. And of course, because he has the one title, he has the most titles as a Nuggets head coach in their franchise's history. This is insane. I have no other way to put it. This is absolutely bonkers what has happened. And when you look at it, what has happened in the NBA, the 3 coaches that have been fired, relatively successful coaches for the franchises that they were with. Mike Brown had a winning record with the Kings almost willed them to a series first round win against the Warriors when they won a title that season. The Grizzlies, most winning coach in Memphis Grizzlies history. Taylor Jenkins fired in the middle of the season. Michael Malone, most winning coach in Nuggets franchise history, fired before the season's over. This has been a wild season when it comes to hiring and firing coaches.
It has to be a result of, in my opinion, the new CBA and how teams are structured too. Because the Taylor Jenkins firing, I think if you were paying attention to the Memphis Grizzlies, that one made a lot of sense. The Denver Nuggets, this one was really surprising because I just didn't expect them to really think that they were going to win an NBA title this year, especially with some of the injuries that they had.
In
the West and the way that it is. And I didn't see this coming at all. But it appears very much like the reaction that happened with Memphis. If you were paying attention to the Nuggets and you are local, it makes all the sense in the world. Because some clips are coming out that Michael Malone was talking about the players won't even watch film.
Yeah.
Anymore,
and
sounds like he completely lost the locker room.
Yep.
So you gotta go. What's really surprising about the Nuggets thing is that they fired the GM too.
Yes, they fired Calvin
because
Booth.
Because those two hated each other. Calvin Booth and Michael Malone hated each other.
That's why I think this ultimately happened. Calvin Booth and Michael Malone never got along, even though they were the architects of the 2023 NBA champ Nuggets. They didn't get along, and I think what you saw is ownership finally just say, if you guys can't get along, we'll get rid of both of you. I'm not going to pick one or the other. I'm tired of this. Get along or you're done. They couldn't get along. They're done. That seems like what happened. But I will say this for Michael Malone's side. I'm a little bit more on Michael Malone's side than I am on Calvin Booth's side. And the reason
I think that makes sense
is because Calvin Booth did not do anything Michael Malone wanted post NBA championship. He just let everybody walk. Bruce Brown, Jeff Green. You just go down the list. He replaced those guys with Peyton Watson and
Jay
Christian
Huff.
Brown. And like, he let all these guys walk. As much as I want to, you know, place the blame at the feet of a coach like Michael Malone and struggling down the stretch of this season, I feel like ultimately we've been having conversations every single offseason since they won a championship about them just letting their roster get depleted completely and hoping and praying that Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray can get them to the promised land. And that's not how you should go about things. You need to have better role players. They balked at the idea of signing KCP for the amount of money that he was going to be worth. They balked at the idea of paying Bruce Brown the money he was going to be worth. They balked at the idea of paying Jeff Green the amount of money he was worth. And you get the results that you get because of that. So I know that they moved on from both of them because they couldn't get along. They were tired of that relationship. But at the same time, it feels like Calvin Booth sort of set this type of thing in motion right after they won the championship in 2023.
Well, and that's why I bring up the CBA. The new CBA makes it very difficult to have sustained success in the NBA with the full roster. Your roster can be top-heavy, and that's basically what happened in the Denver Nuggets. And I think one reason Booth has ultimately got fired, too, is that Jamal Murray contract now looks rough. Because that guy just simply cannot stay healthy, and they're going to have to pay him an obscene amount of money over the next 4 years because his contract, I think, goes into effect this summer. So they're going to have to figure out what they're going to want to do with that. And now, all of a sudden, it has become, oh, the Nuggets might not be a thing anymore. Like, this is interesting. What's going to happen with Jokic now? What's going to happen
with
Murray
now? There's Jokic trade odds now.
There's predicted
trades.
Who is the coach that you're going to bring in? Who is the GM that you are going to bring in? Is there any way to save this thing? Can you improve upon this roster when you already have all this money committed to some of these players? It's going to be really interesting to see what happens to the Denver Nuggets. Now, at the end of the day, they've got the best basketball player in the world, so they're probably going to be fine as long as he's on the roster. But it is really interesting that one of the teams that has been at the top of the Western Conference for the last 3 or 4 years might not be there next season.
And we need to be honest about this offseason when it comes to the coaching carousel and the coaching market.
It's going
to
be nuts.
The three guys I named that were fired midseason, Mike Brown, Taylor Jenkins, and Michael Malone, all probably could get jobs this offseason. The top two there, Michael Malone
and Taylor Jenkins absolutely will get a job. And it sounds like they might be jockeying for maybe the same job down in San Antonio.
That's what I'm saying. And I shout out to DeMichael Cole for this because I'm gonna steal the way he put this. The Spurs are going to be playing eeny, meeny, miny, moe
right. When
it comes to Michael Malone and Taylor Jenkins. Ties there. They know what those guys have given. They've had success in the Western Conference. They've had success building up a team from scratch, young guys. getting them some playoff scars. So the Spurs are just going to be playing eeny, meeny, mighty, mo to figure out, okay, who do we actually want to go forward? I would think they'd probably lean Michael Malone's way because of the championship. But Taylor Jenkins does have ties there.
I thought they might lean Jenkins because of the development.
It's going to be interesting to watch. And I wouldn't say Michael Malone's like not a development coach. He was there since, what, 2017?
Sure, that's fair.
He was there for a long time.
That's very fair, very fair.
Brought along some of their guys. So we'll see. It's going to be an interesting offseason because of the openings we have and the guys that could potentially fill those openings.
What have you made of people saying maybe Michael Malone could come to Memphis?
Don't mind it, to be honest. I think, you know, considering the type of coach he was and what he was able to do to maximize the roster that the Nuggets had at that time, that wasn't just full development mode. I think that it would make sense. Can I say the quiet part out loud?
Sure.
What I'm really feeling? I think Tomas Sasalo is going to get the job.
I am in full agreement.
I'm not necessarily right now interested in talking about a bunch of outside candidates because I tend to think, and Drew Hill wrote a really good article.
Very good.
That you should go check out in the Daily Memphian about Tomas Sasalo and will he get the job? Will he not get the job? How should we be considering his potential candidacy? But it just seems like he's going to end up with a gig. You don't go over to Europe, pay $1 million buyout, fire the rest of the staff except for the guy that you brought in to ultimately balk at the idea of him getting the full-time job. It just feels like even if we were talking about this in the preseason when he was hired, like we thought about this, is he the coach in waiting then? It feels like right now we have taken the steps to get to the point where feels like he's going to be the next head coach of the Memphis Grizzlies.
I agree. I've also liked how the Grizzlies have looked with him. I think it's looked good. The way he's using Edie, the way he's using Ja, it seems like the players are behind him.
Yes, sure.
That's the one thing that worries with Michael Malone.
We've also seen player relationships in the NBA dissolve fast. I don't think we're anywhere close. I mean, we're, what, 5 games into it with Tomas Isolo, anywhere close to that. But I don't think you should make the hire strictly because of player relationships and how
but
they look right now. I think you should hire him because of the offensive ability they've shown lately in maximizing the players that you're trying to give big roles to. Zach Edey, Ja Morant, those types of things.
Now,
that's why you would ultimately give him the job. One thing I do want to say, though, if they do hire Tomas Isolo as the next head coach of the Memphis Grizzlies, I think that they need to think about defensive coordinators going into next year because the defense still – and it looked bad under Taylor Jenkins as well. So this isn't all Tomas Isolo's fault, but we know he's an offensive guy. He may need somebody on his bench that can really run the defense, coordinate the defense.
That's something I can agree with. I can agree with that 100%.
Yep. All right, now let's go ahead and grab a break. And on the other side, we need to talk with Christian Fowler. He joins every single Tuesday. Today is no exception. It's just a little bit earlier, so stick around. Christian Fowler is a senior writer and content creator for Bluff City Media on X at CFowlerBCM. Make sure you go check out our podcast. Releases every single Tuesday on the Bluff City Media and Believe Podcast Networks. It's the On the Bluff podcast. Again, every single Tuesday at noon is when it releases. Christian, how's it going, brother?
Everything's good, Gabe. How you doing?
I am doing well. What'd you think of that ending last night? We end the national championship with the ball on the ground because Emmanuel Sharpe thought that the shot was going to get blocked. His three-point attempt was going to get blocked. That was a very fun game, but the ending with the ball just being batted around on the ground was a little bit much for me.
Yeah, the very ending left a lot to be desired, but I think we had a lot of people that were unamused with the tournament, I guess is a good way to put it, for the most part this season. But the Final Four and the national championship absolutely delivered, and I don't know how you feel about it as a whole, but I think I would take this every year. I would think I would take kind of a decent at best first few rounds for the Final Four in the national championship game to be as good as they were this year, because we've missed that, I feel like, over the last couple seasons. The national championship has not been very exciting over the last several years, but we got a good one this year against, I mean, probably the best two teams in the country. I think the four teams that were in the Final Four, you can make the argument for all of them to be number one or number two. So I think it's fair to say if Florida and Houston are the ones that made it there, they were the best two teams in the country, and it was a highly competitive game. But I was sad to see Kelvin Sampson lose. We talked about it last week on the show. It's what we both wanted. Houston was the team that we wanted to win. You can say whatever reasoning for that, if it's because we're, you know, as people that are local in the city of Memphis, closer to the Houston program than the other programs, just because they were in this conference, or if it's because how beloved Kelvin Sampson is, how respected he is, and how close that he's gotten. Houston is definitely who we were both pulling for. So it was difficult to see him lose, especially in that fashion with having a lead down late. It was kind of the script was kind of flipped from the way that they, beat Duke in the Final Four. So it was heartbreaking to see Kelvin Sampson go out that way, because with a few minutes left, I thought he finally done it. He's finally going to pull it off. And unfortunately he was not able to.
It was just amazing though, to see, you know, listen, Houston's a great team. Offensively, they're not that great though. They never really have been. They shot the three really well this year. They found some open looks, but the final 2 minutes I thought was a microcosm of the things that could catch up to them catching up to them, right? The last 2 minutes, they had no field goal attempts, no points, four turnovers. That's just, you know, that it felt like it took till the final 2 minutes of the entire season for the dam to break on the offensive success for Houston. Now, I will say this. When you look at the tournament at large, I agree with you. I think once we get to the Final Four and the championship game, this is about as good as we can ask for. All the one seeds, duking it out, big brand versus big brand. And I thought different types of matchups, right? You know, you have the really good offensive teams. I think Duke, Auburn fits that, even though they're more balanced. Florida certainly fits that. They were a top five offensive team all year. Houston bringing the defense, so you had different styles of basketball. The one thing I would say, though, is, you know, earlier in the tournament, I would love to see more upsets. That's still the conversation, I think, carrying over from the first couple of weekends.
Yeah, I mean, you can always make that argument because it's fun and exciting. It's crazy if you see a double-digit seed beat one of the top teams in the country. But if that's the sacrifice to get four, and it doesn't have to be one.
To get an A-plus Final Four, Final Three games, if you will.
Correct. If we truly feel like we're down to the best 4 to 8 teams in the country, then I feel like it's impossible for the Final Four and the National Championship not to be exciting games. And honestly, the National Championship game kind of blew me away a little bit yesterday, because I was kind of feeling like, okay, Houston's offense has been better this year. LJ Cryer, Emmanuel Sharp, Juwan Roberts obviously still there, and it's like, are they going to have to outscore Florida to win this game? That sounds obvious, but I mean, in a shootout type of atmosphere, are they going to play up to Florida's offense? Is that how they're going to have to win this game? What is shocking to me about it is 65-63. If you tell anybody that's the final score, you're probably going to say Houston wins that game. I mean, they made Florida play their game. It was ugly. 39% from the floor for Florida, 34% from the floor for Houston. You look at the stars in this game. Like, Walter Clayton was unconscious over the last few games. He was 3 of 10. Elijah Martin, who a lot of Memphis fans probably remember from FAU in their Final Four run, he was 2 of 10. LJ Cryer, 6 of 18, had the best shooting game of pretty much anybody with a decent amount of field goal attempts. Emmanuel Sharp being 3 of 11 really hurt Houston in this game. Juwan Roberts being 3 of 13 really hurt Houston in this game. So if you told Kelvin Sampson and this team this is how this game would play out, I would think they would be there for it all day. Like, this is how they wanted it to be. Mix it up, ugly, old-school style basketball, got to win it on the defensive end and timely baskets. Like, this was a Houston game plan to a T, and credit to Todd Golden and Florida and what they did, and they were able to outplay them in their own style. It wasn't a high-scoring affair. Walter Clayton had 30. This was Florida playing Houston basketball and beating Houston in that manner. It's kind of nuts to think about, because it's not what I expected at all.
And shout out to Florida. The last three rounds of the Elite Eight, the Final Four, and then the National Championship game, they overcame deficits of 9+ points. And yeah. You know, that's sort of what I was highlighting it a little bit earlier, like the difference between the NBA and the college game. You know, in the NBA, late in games, there's just like you don't have enough stoppers to stop a guy like Jokic or LeBron or Luka in the playoffs. But when you get into the college game, you know, it's about who's going to win those half-court sets as you get to the waning minutes. And I thought that Florida just did that at the highest level of anybody in this tournament throughout it. They played some close games. I thought Todd Golden got out-coached in a couple games. That Texas Tech game, certainly. That UConn game. But when push came to shove in those final minutes, he did a good job coaching and his players did a good job executing.
Yeah, and now you can't take anything away from him. I mean, he's kind of been crowned for a while, right? I mean, like since he started at Auburn, Bruce Pearl's really put him on a pedestal and talked about this is the next, like, great coach in college basketball. And credit to Todd Golden, like you said, I mean, it wasn't pretty the whole way. They didn't do what Duke did through the majority of the tournament. Very easily could have lost to UConn. Very easily could have lost to Texas Tech. And they very easily could have lost in the national championship. So, like, you really have to give them credit. We look at Houston as kind of this tough, like, rugged, battle-tested team. And Florida really showed throughout the tournament that they were the best in that category. Like, they were the most battle-tested. They were the ones that were ready for the close games. And I think, you know, that it obviously starts with Todd Golden and the staff and the players. But I think it's also a credit to the SEC and what playing in that conference does for you, because you get so used to playing tight games against very, very good opponents. I mean, you look around the conference, Tennessee, Auburn, Ole Miss, Arkansas, all these teams that were in the tournament, went deep in the tournament and, you know, had success in SEC play. And I think that prepares a team like Florida to go in there and say, look, we've been in these tightly contested games. We might not have the reputation of a Houston or a St. John's or a team like that that's just generally looked at as like tough and battle tested, but they proved better than anybody that late in the game, they were the best team. It didn't matter what the deficit was. They were able to overcome pretty much everything in this tournament.
Yeah, in college basketball, talent matters. But I think in the end of the day, toughness. Toughness brings it home. It brings it all the way back around. That's why both of these teams lasted as long as they didn't have a chance to fight it out for the national title. Now let's go ahead and get to some Memphis basketball. They have their first commit through the class coming out of the transfer portal. Quante Berry from Temple. It's the ninth guy in the last 4 years that has transferred from in the American Athletic Conference to Memphis. But Quante Berry, 10 points per game, I think around 4 rebounds, 2 assists per game, shot around 33% from three, but that's not what he does the best. He's going to be a true junior. What he does the best is getting to the rim at a very high level and finishing at a very high level. I think on his drives, he has a 56% field goal percentage. What did you think about this first commit that Penny Hardaway and company got?
I mean, it's kind of in line with the last couple of classes, right? I mean, like you said, Penny has really dipped into the AAC pool to bring in players, and not to draw like such a easy, simple parallel, but it kind of feels similar to a couple of years ago when the first commit was Nick Jourdain. And people were like, this is good. It's a good start. Like, it's not the sexiest thing in the world. It's not going to draw the biggest headlines, but it's a solid player. And like, if you watch Temple, you look at Quante Berry, you go, that's a really solid player for the American Athletic Conference. So I think it's not the biggest move they'll make. It's not the most exciting move that they'll make, but I think it's one of those that's necessary to have a roster like they did this year where you can trust 9 to 10 guys 100%, where you're not worried about, can this guy do this in this moment? Can we trust him in this situation? I think Quante Berry brings that. And like I said, I think you can draw a lot of similarities between this addition and Nick Jourdain. Obviously completely different positions. They do completely different things, but just as far as from like a apples to apples comparison of this isn't the number one guy that you're looking for in this class, in this transfer class, but it's the type of player that is necessary to have a successful roster.
And he can stick around for a couple of years, right? Because he's going to be a true junior. I think that's a fair comparison. Obviously, I get it's not perfect because they play different positions, but I get where you're going with that. Now, I talked about it yesterday. Where do they go from here? If you're looking at Penny's next move and what you want to see the next commit be from a position standpoint, what do you want to see Penny do?
I want to go back to the length. You know, I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago and how much smaller this Memphis team was in comparison to years past. And I think getting a good stretch four or a three that is, you know, 6'7", 6'8", kind of in the build of Jaquan Walton. I think that's the player that we talked about a couple weeks ago as well. Just having a guy with that length and size and athleticism that he doesn't necessarily have to be the best offensive player in the country. Like, we've seen Penny Hardaway's style. He wants the majority of his offense to either come from a dominant big man or someone in the backcourt. Like, that's kind of the formula. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an offensive superstar. If it is, that obviously doesn't hurt. But, like, getting someone who is not just average or not just solid on the defensive end, but an elite defensive player at the three with good length, good size, can do a little bit of everything, can shoot if he needs to, can get to the basket, but more than anything, just a heck of a defensive player. Like, that is what I want to see, because I don't think he's going to have issues getting a really good lead guard. He has had no trouble doing that in the past. There's nothing in it.
And Dante Harris is on the roster still. So that's
right.
You know, if that's the plan, I think he's comfortable with that. He probably wants somebody a little bit better, but I think he'd be comfortable with Dante Harris.
Right. So I don't think they're going to have any troubles with that, but I do want to see that change. Also, front court. I mean, we've seen him land a lot of front court talent, so I'm not worried about that either, but I just want to see, like, a centerpiece of the defense at the three position. I think that's what we talked about, is how much they missed that last year, not having that length and athleticism, someone who can match up pretty much with the one through a four or two through a four. Having a guy like that just is an eraser, takes away an opposing team's best player, I think that's something that I would want to see that as the next addition. I think that would be huge to get somebody at that three that's elite.
Yeah. Now, final thing, we're within 20 days of the NFL draft, and I'm going to throw you on the spot, and we're going to talk about this plenty before we actually get there with your Tuesday hits. But who are your guys in this draft? Who do you really love? Who's, like, and obviously I hate doing the can't miss thing, but, like, if you're sort of tabbing your can't miss guys in this NFL draft, holler at me.
See, this is one of my favorite questions every year, right? Because I'm pretty much every single year I've went through and said, this is the guy that you can't miss on. Like, this is the guy that will be – yeah, this guy will be a perennial Pro Bowler every year. Doesn't matter. I think last year I said that was Joe Alt. I think we ended up agreeing on that one. This year is a little bit more difficult to me. I don't think they're – is as much top-end talent. One that I love is Abdul Carter. I know that's easy. That's low-hanging fruit because he's one of the best players in the draft, could potentially be the number one overall pick. But you just watch him and his tape just jumps off the screen at you. Like, he's very similar to Micah Parsons. I know that comparison's been made a lot, especially same number, same school. But, like, 1 year at defensive end and the things that he's able to do with his speed and athleticism and quickness, like, if he gets in the right situation, I don't see any way that he doesn't succeed. Travis Hunter is another easy one, whether it's on one side or both sides. I don't see him not being successful. Will Campbell. I love Will Campbell at LSU.
Although there's some questions about his arm length and will you have to kick him inside and play guard. I think if you have to kick him inside and play guard, he could be a decade-long player and still potentially be in Pro Bowls. So I'm with you there.
But I'll give you two guys that I think are Pro Bowlers this year in their first season. First one, Ashton Jeanty. No-brainer.
I was going to say, my can't miss is a lot. They come out of this running back class. This is one of the best running back classes we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, this running back class is stacked. I mean, you obviously it starts with Ashton Jeanty, but then you look at Amarian Hampton, Travion Henderson, Quinshon Judkins, and the list just kind of goes on and on. Caleb Johnson from Iowa. Like, this is a loaded running back class. But Ashton Jeanty, I think, is a Pro Bowler in year one. This one's a little bit trickier. I wouldn't guarantee as much, but if he gets in the right situation, a lot of people have him going to Chicago. I think if he goes to Chicago, very likely could be a Pro Bowler in year one, Tyler Warren. I think he's one of the most NFL-ready prospects in the draft. I mean, he's big, he's strong, he's athletic. He can block, he can catch, he can get down the seam. Like, he can do a little bit of everything. And then a dark horse for me, staying first round, but a dark horse for me, someone that I think could be a monster in year one, is Tyler Booker. Interior offensive linemen don't get talked about as much, but Tyler Booker, just with his size and the way that he moves at his size, like if you get him with the right offensive line coach, with the right pieces around him, and he's not like the only decent offensive lineman, I think he could be like a fringe Pro Bowler type player in year one, too.
And Christian, I say this to everyone who will listen to me, because I know like when we talk about the offensive line, people will look at the tackles, and they want to draft tackles in the first round because of positional value. Usually, if you're drafting a first or second round guard or center, it's like they never miss. Like, generally never miss. I think center, when it comes to first round picks, has the highest percentage, the highest hit rate of any position that you could potentially draft in the first two rounds of the NFL draft. And that's, I think, since the 21st century began. Like, it's like an 80-something percent hit rate when you draft center in the first or second round.
Yeah, just think about the last 2 years with, or maybe two of the last 3 years with Tyler Linderbaum and Graham Barton. Like those are, Tyler Linderbaum's one of the best in the league already, and then Graham Barton had a great rookie season in Tampa. So I think you're absolutely right. The centers, the interior offensive linemen, they're not talked about, they're overlooked. But if you get one of those guys, especially in the first round, like you're pretty much
usually works out
like a 10-year starter. Like that guy's probably going to be in the NFL for 10 years. Ceilings obviously range, but you get really elite guys in the first round because of the low positional value of guard. You can get a guy 15 to 25 that is a Pro Bowler in year one. I mean, look at a guy like Zach Martin, who just had one of the best offensive line careers of all time. I think Dallas got him at 16, even though he's one of the best players in the draft.